Welcome to episode number 27 of the First Responder Wellness Podcast, and this is a special bonus edition of the show, and I'm thrilled that you've joined us. My name is Conrad Weaver, and I'm so excited to be able to bring our film to Maine for a couple of special events this week. And so that's why we have this special edition, because our guest is from Maine. So you'll learn about him in just a minute. But be sure to check out our website and social media pages to get all the information about all the events coming up. If you'd like to bring the film to your city and community, be sure to fill out the screening information form on our website at PTSD911movie.com. That's PTSD911movie.com. All one word, .com. Jason Mills is the founder and CEO of the Resilient Responder, a training and consulting business for first responders. But Jason is also a retired fire lieutenant and flight medic up in Maine, and he's currently finishing up his master's degree in clinical mental health and counseling with a focus on first responders. So stay tuned for our compelling and very interesting conversation. Thanks so much for listening to this podcast. I know you're busy, and so I appreciate you taking time to listen. And I'm also grateful for everyone who's joining us on YouTube. Our YouTube channel is growing like crazy, and we're so excited about that. So if you haven't subscribed, be sure to hit the subscribe button and the little bell that'll notify you every time we post something new on the podcast and on the YouTube channel. So be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts as well, or wherever you listen to podcasts, because this really helps us get the word out to more people about the show. And if you could do me a favor, I'd really appreciate it if you would take a minute to rate and review the show. This would mean the world to me, and it will help us get the word out to more people. Thanks again for listening and for watching. And now here's my conversation with Jason Mills. Well, Jason, welcome to the First Responder Wellness Podcast on this special edition here in March. We're coming to Maine, and so I thought, hey, let's get a Maine firefighter on the show. So, Jason, welcome.
I appreciate you having me onto the show, and I appreciate you coming into Maine and doing the work that you're doing for the first responder community. So, glad to be here.
Yeah. So, for the audience, let us know, you know, what's your connection to as a first responder? What did you do? What do you do?
Yeah, so the connection as a first responder goes back a long time. My dad was the fire chief in our community when I was growing up. Started as a volunteer in our town. Have a family that's pretty much full of first responders. I have two brothers that are Maine State Troopers. My brother-in-law is a retired battalion chief from Augusta Fire Department. My best friend and I started through the kind of the junior program, going through high school, and then worked at the same department together. He's gone on, he works in Portland Fire. He's now the chief of our town. So kind of everybody that has been in my community or influential in my life growing up has been somehow involved in community service as a first responder. Hmm. And so I started the way I got here to the point that I'm at now, the shortish long story is started at a four-year college, realized that wasn't for me. Came back, went to KVCC to get a paramedic certificate, started the Augusta Fire Department in 1997. And along the way, kind of wore a lot of different hats, as a lot of us do, owned a couple of businesses along the way, went to work for Life Flight of Maine for a while, for several years, did that concurrently, and went through my career. And as a lot of us do, not everything went that well. And I tell people when I speak, or to anybody that will listen to me now, that I didn't get to this position I'm in now because everything went well. I kind of took a little bit of a bumpier path getting there. And so partway through my career, towards the end of it mostly, I started being a little bit more aware of the mental health and mental resiliency of firefighters. And what I found for myself and for the other, my friends and colleagues that I would speak to, is that when we were reaching out for help with mental health issues, first of all, we were reaching out way, way late in the game. Right? We weren't going in because we had some small problems to address. We were going in because either relationships or careers were falling apart in some pretty big way. But what we found was that we weren't necessarily getting access to people who we felt understood us. And so the experience wasn't fantastic. And when so we came back from that less willing to engage in that process going forward. And so as I got close to retiring, I had this idea that starts kicking around in my head that looks like, well, maybe you could be a counselor, which I tried pretty hard to kick out of my head as soon as I could, because everything about my identity was, you know, I grew up, I was a football player, I was a wrestler, I owned a construction company, I was a firefighter, and I didn't do the mental health stuff. I didn't do that, and it wasn't part of my life. But this was something that wouldn't go away. And so eventually I start to let this in. I have a conversation about my wife with my wife about it. And she said, well, maybe you should look into it further. And I look into it further and I make this agreement with myself that I'll do this, but I'm going to do it under maybe my own terms-ish. And if I'm going to do mental health, I'm going to do it as the way that I think will be helpful to first responders. So I enrolled in school, got a master's degree in clinical mental health, and just recently got licensed through the state of Maine. So here I am in, as a mental health practitioner, mental health provider. And then on the side from that, I teach at SMCC, teaching health, wellness, and safety for the fire science program down there. And I own the Resilient Responder, which is the company that teaches firefighter mental health and resiliency. And so I've had a lot of fun with that, going out, reaching out to our first responders and having a little bit of sharing what my experience was, but also a little bit of sharing what I've learned through the process of formal education. And I'm having a good time with it, and hopefully it's helping the people that are out there that need the help.
What were some of those symptoms in your life while you were a firefighter? Some of those things that maybe kept cropping up in your life that made you kind of think twice about this mental health thing?
Well, so I, like I mentioned, you know, I, like a lot of other firefighters, I went through a divorce. And, you know, part of what was a real awakening for me after all this fact was, a lot of the things that I didn't like that were happening in my life were things that I was doing to myself. And some of those things were due some of it to the job, some of it to personality, but I was overloading myself. I was always taking on something more. I was always looking for a distraction. I was always looking for the next thing. And so I was never really present in the moment to be there, you know, through all the events that I wanted to be or should have wanted to be present for. And so my relationships started to break down. And that kind of was maybe the real turning point, was life's not working out the way that I thought it might work out. And, you know, my health was back and forth. You know, sometimes I was very compulsive. Sometimes I would be in fantastic shape and sometimes I would be not in so much shape. So physically I was in and out of a good spot. Emotionally, I was in and out of a good spot. And I think that a lot of the, there was certainly some impact from some really critical calls, and that stuff wasn't addressed at that time in a way that was beneficial. And so what happened was, and what I talk about through my resiliency stuff, is that I was coming into work in not a great place to be at work, which meant that everything that happened at work had a bigger impact on me and just compounded all the other problems in all the other areas of my life.
And you mentioned you were part of the Life Flight, you know, group there. Yeah. That, to me, as an outsider looking in and knowing what they do here in Maryland, the Life Flight kind of is responding to some of the worst places.
Yeah, the acuity of the calls for Life Flight is, it is typically the worst of the worst calls. They have, you know, they're the ones that are being called to transport from scenes, you know, scene calls of motor vehicle accidents, of, you know, shootings, whatever it may be. But also the ones that are taking the people from the highest acuity from the community hospitals to the tertiary hospitals down to Portland and to Boston. And so almost every interaction that they have at a patient level is high stress.
Sure.
And it's, and that, you know, and that, then you add in all the other components of the air medical service, the safety components of it that are just innate to, you know, flying in a helicopter.
Sure.
And the stress load becomes pretty significant.
And did that also play a role in your journey?
The stress part of it, certainly. And what happened with my career in Life Flight, because there was a point that that's all I wanted to do. Like, I wanted to be a flight medic.
That become intoxicating just to be a part of that team?
It did, because we were operating at such a high level that it really did make you feel like you were part of something elite. And I still believe that. I still have friends that are part of Lifelight, and I still believe that they are, you know, functioning at a really high level, and they're providing some of the best pre-hospital medicine available in the state. What happened for me is during that period of time that I was working at Lifelight, I also owned two different businesses, and I was still working at the fire department, and I had young kids. So I'm going through all of this, and really what kind of, what brought the Lifelight career, or the life, my engagement with Lifelight to an end, was it was the time of my life that I was going through a divorce. And I had to make a decision. Like, my kids are important to me, and I need to be able to spend time with my children. And how am I supposed to be able to do that if I work 48 hours at the fire station and I run these two other businesses, and I'm getting onto this helicopter for, you know, 12, 24 hours a week per diem? And what I felt was I couldn't keep up the level of education that I needed to have to be proficient and be good at my job. And it wasn't something I wanted to sacrifice. But I also needed to be there to be available for my children as, you know, as they were growing up. And it's a time that you don't get to get back. And the further you get away from that, the more acutely aware you become that that's a limited time. They're both grown, and one is 22 and the other one will be 20 in a couple weeks. And they're both doing very well. But those, that period of time, you know, when they're playing youth sports and they're doing all the things in school, and you don't get it back. And I wanted to be there to be part of it. So that was what ultimately, you know, had me step away from that Lifelight career.
Mm-hmm. Was that a difficult decision for you?
In some ways it was, but I drew the line pretty quickly when I knew that it was going to be probably either that or being able to be with my kids. Mm-hmm. However, it's one of the things that still is reoccurring to me, even in recurrent dreams about getting into the helicopter and getting ready to go on a flight. And part of that is that I did feel really honored to be part of that group. It was a fantastic group. I've never learned more in my life. I used to kind of joke and say that I was the dumbest of a very, very smart group of people. And I really learned valuable lessons out of that. The amount that I learned just about medicine was immense. It was incredible. But I also really learned some stuff about leadership from some of the people that were running that program at that time. And a woman that I think is a good friend of mine, and just what it meant to be a strong leader. And so I really appreciate what I took out of that experience and was able to apply going forward, even though I wasn't part of that group. And we have a group called the Lifelight Old Timers Group that still gets together occasionally and
kind of reminisce and talk about.
Reminisce about the good old days. Yeah, it was. We had a lot of good times together. So, and hopefully had a good impact on a lot of people's lives.
So you mentioned that your dad was a fire chief. How much influence did that have, or just the stories he would bring home, that influenced you not only in your career, but also kind of that trauma perhaps that he experienced that he brought to the table when you were young?
Yeah. So this is, it was a lot, because I never knew a time that my dad wasn't the fire chief in our town. And it's a small town. So it was, for me, it was important. When we had fire safety prevention week, it was my dad that came in and gave the speeches and stuff. So that was an important thing for me. And I think it affected him, you know, in ways, but in ways that at that period of time, especially with him and with his background, that were difficult for him to ever acknowledge, mm-hmm. to ever express. Mm-hmm. And I think about how that affected me. I started very, very young in this. Because my dad was the chief and a little bit of a renegade, I started in this line of work probably before, you know, maybe Bureau of Labor Standards and things would have liked to have acknowledged. But I was in, you know, at the fire station and hanging around at a pretty young age. I just told this story, ironically enough, 2 days ago at a class that I was teaching. The first time I did CPR was when I was 13 years old. Wow. I was in eighth grade. And it was on somebody that I knew. I knew who the person was. And I left that call and went to my eighth grade dance.
Wow.
And that's the way it was.
Wow.
And, you know, I can recall being in high school and going to fatal car accidents. And it wasn't until I was well into my career into Augusta that we were doing any type of debriefings. And debriefings at that point were, they were kind of in their infancy, at least for our department, and they weren't necessarily run in the way that they're run today. And so what we found was that the outcome wasn't always fantastic. The people that the recipients of the intervention sometimes left, oftentimes left, not feeling any better and sometimes worse.
I've heard stories of people saying that their debriefings were like, they'd get in the room like, everybody okay? You okay? You okay? Yeah, we're all good. And that was it.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a lot of times the unwillingness or the inability for people to actually feel like that was a place that they could say that something's going on, that this is a little bit more. And even in the event, you know, immediately after the event, I think it's hard for us to gauge whether we actually are okay or not.
Sure.
We don't really know. I think we're doing a system recheck and trying to figure out, well, I don't know if I'm okay. I guess I'm okay. But the effects of that get ingrained in us. And then I think come out when it starts complicating relationships, other decision-making processes. And that's where we really get down this road of, wow, the stuff that's happening at work, even if I don't think it's tangible, even if I don't think that there's a real impact right now, actually is having a significant effect on me, is how I operate. Because what happens is it changes our worldview. And when it changes our worldview, then it starts changing our relationships.
So you can kind of pull that thread and see how it's all that stuff's connected, right?
Yeah, there are really no parts of our lives that aren't interconnected with the others. And when we start having damage inflicted in one area, it's hard to just say, well, that's just work. You know, sometimes people will say, I leave work at work. I'm like, yeah, do you though? Because you probably don't. And maybe you think you do, but I bet if we were to talk to your wife or your kids or, you know, hang out with your dog for a little bit, you know, one of those would tell us that maybe the things that happen at work aren't so compartmentalized to work as you might think they are.
I remember back a few years ago, I was working on another film and I was doing ride-alongs with law enforcement, and it was interesting how just being in a police car, sheriff's deputy's car for 6 hours on a night shift can start changing your perspective.
Yeah.
You know, I was with the drug interdiction team, and we'd be sitting on the interstate, you know, looking for cars with dope in them, and they'd pull a car over and sure enough, there's dope. And they kind of taught me how to spot these cars. And I started doing that on my own when I was driving down the highway. Oh, I bet that car's dirty. I bet that's one that's got dope in it. And it changed my perspective, even that short time. So I can't imagine if you're in this world and in that world you were in 24/7, how that changes your worldview.
Yeah, it certainly does. You know, if you're a florist, you probably think a lot about flowers. And if you're a banker, you probably think a lot about money. And, you know, if you're an educator, you probably think a lot about, you know, students and the curriculum. And if you're a first responder, you start thinking about the threats to your life and the damage that's being done to society through different things. And so it starts to reframe things. When everybody else is just looking at the world, you're looking at the world and looking for the threats in it. An interesting thing, this is, you know, kind of a phenomenon that's, you know, goes across all of the first responder cultures, is that if you go out to eat with a group of first responders, every single one of them wants to sit someplace in the restaurant where they can see the door.
Right.
And I ask people when I do my, you know, when I get a chance to teach and this comes up, I'll say, well, when you were 6 years old and you went to McDonald's with your parents, did you care where you sat? And inevitably, everybody says, no, I didn't care. So I said, well, something between the age that you were 6 years old going to McDonald's and the age that you are now, something happened in your life to tell your brain that you need to be looking at that entrance door all the time because you are concerned about your safety and you're worried about the threat. So there's been some type of cognitive switch. But we also know that cognitive switch is actually hardwired into part of our survival system. And that we're rewiring parts of our brain, and you know, in the same way that if you were to exercise a muscle, you know, that you would get stronger, and the coordination would become better. When all we do is look for threats, the parts of our brain that receive threat information gets better and stronger and faster, and now we set this cycle of being really good at looking for and finding threats.
So how do you unwire the rewired brain?
Yeah, so that's the tough part. So all of the things that are going to happen to us because of our job experience and the occupational hazards of being first responders, this stuff all happens completely naturally. This is all part of your biological response to trying to make you survive to the next day. And so that's the question is, how do you start unwiring things that are happening actively? And part of it is, now I do this thing called a dot drill, where we have people focus on different colored dots and we have them count them. And, you know, we have them count the red dots. And what we find is that when we repeat this over and over and have them change into different patterns, they become really good at finding these red dots, right? One, because the brain adapts to finding red dots pretty quickly. And two, once they know the number that's on the page, they just predict the outcome. And this is what's happening to our first responders. We're getting better at seeing threats, but then we're just predicting outcomes, whether they're actually going to happen or not. So the way we start undoing that is everything about that has to start being done intentionally. All the stuff that's done automatically now has to be intentionally undone. And some of that is stuff like mindfulness training, intentionally looking for the good that's out there, because I still believe that. I still believe that there's a lot of good left in the world. Sure. We just skip over it. We just skip all the other colored dots, if you will, because we're so focused on one thing.
It's kind of like when you buy a Ford Taurus, a red Ford Taurus, you see all the Ford Tauruses out there, right?
Yes, exactly. And this is what happens. So we end up trying to be more mindful of our situation. The other thing that I've talked a lot about is this, you know, this physiological response to threat and to trauma is obviously kicking in our fight or flight system. And so part of that is this, we're getting dumped with massive amounts of cortisol, not once in a while, but all the time. And so we're looking at ways that we decrease our cortisol levels. And some of these things that decrease our cortisol levels are some of the things that are combating that automatic response to be hyper-focused on threats and to be hyper-vigilant. So when we think about the trauma response is a very basic response. That fight or flight is very basic response. When we talk about getting out of that and how do we correct for that, it becomes all of the things that are a higher level of functioning. And so if we can engage in activities, art, music, socialization, spirituality or religion, being active in our environments, those are all things that, one, we know will reduce cortisol levels, but also will reverse the effects of that stress response and that chronic threat that we're under.
I had a question that floated through my mind and it floated right out as a result of getting as old as I am. So what was the, in your journey, when you maybe went off to school to get your advanced degree, what was that aha moment for you where it just kind of like, okay, wow, this makes sense now. And what did you do with that?
I'm trying to think. So this is, I guess the aha moment is maybe still waiting to come, if you will. The aha moment might be, let me think about this, Conrad. I think that the aha is maybe that I'm blessed to be in this position, to be helping people, that I, in a position that I never thought that I would be in. I think if there's an aha moment outside of that, it is that there are a lot of people like me and a lot of people like my friends that need help. Here's the thing that I found about mental health struggles. And I actually really enjoyed this in the documentary, is that it didn't offer a single issue treatment for it or a single answer. In your video, I saw, you know, equine therapy looked like it was in there. Mm-hmm. There was some sports therapy in there. There was a resiliency piece in there. One of the gentlemen in the movie, Maddie, was very connected to his spiritual, to a spiritual connection at the end where he really found religion. Mm-hmm. And that was the piece that worked for him. What I found going through this is that we have to be able to offer a lot of resources. Because what we need to do is connect with the end user. And the end user is the person that's the first responder that needs help. And what works for that person is the only thing that really matters. And it seemed that sometimes we were trying to do this, maybe one size fits all for everybody. Mm-hmm. All first responders are gonna get this. And what I've learned and what's been really impactful for me is that everybody embraces this in some different way. And so what allowed me to get into this profession was saying, I'm going to do this the way that I want to do it. And it has to be from something that I feel is authentic to me. And that's okay, because some people will hear my message and receive it really well. But what I hope is that there are other people putting out a message that is different than mine that somebody else is going to hear. And so I think that is probably, if the aha moment is, there is no one size fits all here for us. And what I want is to have a community of first responders and first responder clinicians that are all approaching this in a way that, you know, maybe you identify with the way that I present this. But there might be other people that say, that doesn't really work for me. His doesn't work for me. But, you know, maybe Jody's way of doing it. I work with a fantastic woman named Jody, and she's been a great mentor for me. But we have different styles. And so maybe Jody's message is the way that somebody else receives it better. And so what's important is to have the options out there. And I think that is what I'm trying to do and what makes me feel good about this. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'll make this analogy to, you know, if you're going to a personal trainer, right? There's probably 100 different ways that you could possibly get in shape. And, you know, could you do it by swimming? Sure. Could you do it by, you know, this, that, or whatever? The one that works is the one that you'll do. Mm-hmm. And that's the take home mm-hmm. on this is mental health is, what way am I going to do this, or what way is this going to be presented that I say, yeah, that's for me. Like, that message is the one that resonates for me. I can connect with that person and I can make this work because it's a partnership. You know, the most predictive measure of whether therapy will work is not the type of therapy. It's not the level of education of the provider. It's whether there's a sense of connection. Mm. And that's kind of been researched and proven over and over. And so that's the important part, is to get people out there that our first responders identify with and feel comfortable with. Mm-hmm.
That's why I love doing this podcast, because I bring so many different perspectives to the table. Mm-hmm. And, yeah. You know, yours can be very different from the next person. And so within right. those stories, something's going to resonate with yes. a listener. So how do you convince a firefighter, you know, John, who's been squirting water on fires for 20 years and doing all the things that firefighters and paramedics do? How do you convince John to see a therapist or to get help or to convince him that maybe he should talk to someone about the stuff that's going on in his life?
Yeah. You know, that's the difficult part is we know that the work that we're doing is successful, and we know that there's a benefit to it. However, there's also still a real wall and a real resistance to it. I think that the way around that for the entire community is trust. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that there's any other way to do that. I think that you have to start developing trust. And that's trust on a personal level. Mm-hmm. That's trust that if you're a first responder and you come see me as Jason, the clinician, that you can trust that everything that happens in that relationship is, one, confidential, but two, that I'm going to be looking out for your best interest. I'm going to be doing as much as I can to try to help you as the person, to try to find the right solution for you. Not the one that I think is best, not the one that would work for me, not the one that worked for the last five people I saw, but the one that's self-directed by you to get you the help that you need. I think that's the initial part, but there also has to be trust on an administrative level. Mm. Like we have to start bringing this to the front so that anything that's happening from a mental health standpoint in the workplace is never punitive, mm. right? Mm-hmm. We need to have the freedom to be able to say, things aren't going that great right now, and have administrative policies in place that allow for that person to go out and seek the treatment they need. And that comes from, from within the department, that comes from leadership in the department, and that comes from beyond that, from the people that are insuring the fire departments. You know, are our employees allowed, if they need, to step away from the job to get themselves healthy to come back? I think a lot of times that doesn't happen. And so we run employees at a substandard performance for a very long time until something happens that breaks. Mm-hmm. Coming up in just a couple of weeks is a Maine Fire Chiefs Conference, and I'm going to do a presentation on that about mental health from a fleet maintenance perspective. Mm-hmm. When we buy equipment in the fire department, we know how much we're going to spend on it to maintain it, mm-hmm. and it's prioritized. And so every week, the truck is checked, and every certain amount of miles, the oil is changed, and the tires are rotated and all this. And because we know that in an emergency situation, we need that piece of equipment to function at its highest level. But that's not something that we do for our employees. Mm. You know, I can go to the department and say, how much have you budgeted to maintain that tower truck? And they probably have a pretty good idea. They can also tell me who's going to do it. Mm-hmm. We're not just letting anybody step in. And even to the extent that somebody says, well, we have a mechanic that can do it. Well, are you a mechanic that works on fire apparatus? Mm-hmm. And that's where we get to be with our clinical mental health, is that not everybody is designed and not everybody has the cultural competence to be working with our first responders. Mm-hmm. And that's something that you don't want to be identifying when there's a crisis. Right.
And putting that into the budget is such a huge thing. I don't know if you, there's a couple of episodes ago, I interviewed a fire captain out of Texas, and he helped his city do that.
I saw the beginning of that, that podcast. His name slips me right now, but, it is a person that I would like to get into contact with. Yeah. Because he, I saw that and I thought, that's the way that this needs to go. This should be the framework for all the departments.
Yeah. I'm pulling up the episode here. It was episode number 19, Jeremy Fuller.
Fuller,
he's out of Little Elm, Texas. And it was amazing. And he said, you know, as when you look at the budget of the fire department or the budget of the city, it's just a tiny, tiny amount that they allocated. Yes. And 100% of their firefighters and their families were covered.
Yeah. And what we know is that the money is well spent. It's not that this hasn't been studied in other places. The World Health Organization says that for every dollar that you spend on employee health and wellness, you save $4 on the other side. Wow. from sickness, lack of performance, absenteeism, all of these things. People that are one of the big things, at least in our area now for fire departments, is recruitment and retention. Mm-hmm. There are more job openings than we have qualified firefighters mm-hmm. for. And one of the big areas that you can look at in both, what would a mental health program help is, well, we can bring people in because prospective employees are looking for departments that value their employees, sure. their employees. And certainly nothing says that more than comprehensive health and wellness and resiliency programs that are part of the department culture. Mm-hmm. And so that helps bring people in, but it also keeps them there. Mm-hmm. Sure. When you're talking about having a firefighter leave for another department, or just leave the profession altogether, you have to bring somebody else in now, and that person has to be trained.
And how much does that cost?
Right. What's the cost of that? You know, some of the departments are running formal training programs. I believe Portland Fire has an 8-week formal training program. And so there's at least 8 weeks of paying somebody that is not actually providing the service to the community, and they're not training themselves. You've got to hire somebody to do the training. And then I'm sure there's other associated cost with it. So,
and you're losing all that, those years of experience as well. You're bringing in someone new, but they have no experience like the person who left. Well,
yes, exactly. So the amount of money that it costs to turn over an employee for one that's left that would have otherwise stayed is huge. And, you know, then there's other things that fall into this, like, workers' comp cases mm-hmm. where people leave because they're having struggles. And a lot of those, I've talked to a lot of those people, tons of those people I've spoken with. You're probably familiar with the Center of Excellence.
Yes.
It's down
in just an hour from my house here. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I was lucky enough to go down there last spring. It's a fantastic facility, right? It's a huge resource for members of the fire service, but it is essentially a crisis intervention facility. And what would be good is if we weren't using that as our mental health program, because a lot of departments, you have a couple of options. You have EAP, which doesn't necessarily connect you with a culturally competent clinician for first responders, or things unravel and you go to the center. But that's not without consequences for both the department and the employee. And the members that I've talked to that have been down, they had really good experiences there and they're glad it was there. But they have almost all said, I wish I hadn't had to go. Glad it was there. But if I had been able to avoid this by being more proactive, and I've asked some of them, how far back do you think that you would have had to rewind your circumstances to be able to avoid going? Because at some point, you know, you've tipped over the edge, and that's probably inevitable. And some of them said, you know, if I could have gone back a year, if I would have had a year of support and access to good quality mental health services, I probably could have avoided this.
Wow.
So, you know, the proactive approach to this is really for money, from the, you know, the dollar standpoint is really the smart thing to do.
How can we convince the bean counters to make that investment? You know, what does it take to get their attention to that? Hey, this is a priority. There should be a priority.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's going to be my goal for this conference coming up in a couple of weeks. And I'll get back to you to let you know how well I did with that. But I think it works from a couple of different perspectives. One is budgets are tight. I don't think that we should pretend that everybody just has money to spend anywhere. So in training, money is really tough to come by. So because there are all the other things that you have to have, you know, you've got to put fuel in the truck, you've got to pay your employees, you have to, you know, all those things, you've got to have supplies. So the training budgets are sometimes the ones that are squeezed down. But this money that could be spent here, if we can illustrate that it's saving money on the other side, I think that's where this starts to change the conversation about not only is this a thing that you should do because it's the right thing for employees, but you should do this also because it's the right thing for the taxpayers that are funding the departments. Portland Fire a couple of years ago has hired an in-house clinician. So they have a full-time clinician, great guy named Oliver Burdine, that set up some fantastic training for us. We just went to a week-long training with him and that he brought in last week. And the evidence that they have on their mental health reduction after bringing Oliver in full-time is pretty convincing. The amount of members that were going to the Center of Excellence has substantially decreased. So that's affecting their insurance rates, and that is affecting, you know, time off from work, missed work, overtime that they're having to pay to backfill shifts for other people while they're gone. So there's some pretty convincing stuff there. The other part that has to be part of this is that we can't just push back onto administration and say, well, if people would just throw more money at this, then this would be all solved. There has to be a point where we start taking responsibility as the employees of what am I doing in the other areas of my life? And that's, you know, as I mentioned earlier, when I realized that a lot of the things that were going badly in my life were my fault, it made it a little easier to correct because I knew where the source of the problem was. And I think if we push back a little bit on employees and say, the job that we're doing, we're not selling ice cream out here. Every day that you come to work, you're dealing with life and death and the life of other people or potentially the life, your own life, and say, what condition are you coming into work? And, you know, when you come to work at 7 o'clock in the morning, how ready are you to absorb the impacts that might be presented to you today? Mm-hmm. And so when I do my resiliency-based stuff, my definition of resiliency is the ability to absorb an impact. Mm-hmm. And one of the tools that I use to illustrate this, I borrow from the law enforcement side, but I use a bulletproof vest. Mm-hmm. And putting on a bulletproof vest doesn't tell you anything. It doesn't say you're not going to get hit. That's not what it does. There's no guarantee that if you have a vest on that you're not going to get shot. It doesn't tell you that you're not going to get hit. Doesn't tell you you're not going to get hurt. Doesn't tell you you're not going to get knocked down. doesn't tell you you're not going to need help from somebody else. The only thing that it does is it increases your ability to be able to get back on your feet and keep fighting. And we have resiliency tools available to us that we know in the same way will increase our personal resiliency to be able to absorb some of these impacts and move on. You know, resiliency training, if you look at some of the studies, reduces things like anxiety and depression by up to 40%. And then it increases quality of life factors by the same amount. So if we're looking at one of the things that's big issue in the fire service is suicide. Mm-hmm. Right? And so if we look at that and go, if you took somebody that was suicidal and made them 40% less anxious, 40% less depressed, and increased their life by 40%, would they still be suicidal? And so you can make a pretty good argument that we'll probably not right. at that point.
Right? Sure.
And so the resiliency training, the proactive training is addressing the suicide issue as well. Mm. So I think that that's where we want to be focusing on is stuff has to be supported by administration. There has to be support for that, but there also has to be ownership from the members on how am I coming to work today? Because we know that somebody that in most areas of their life is functioning very well. When that person comes to work, they're not likely to just fall apart because they're in a work mm-hmm. environment. So if I come into work and, you know, I know who I am, which is part of that spiritual connection. I know what I stand for. My finances are in good shape. My relationships are in good shape. I'm healthy physically. I'm working to improve my intellectual ability. I'm working at my occupational resiliency. So I'm trying to become a better employee. If we take that person and then we subject that person to a traumatic incident, their ability to navigate that is way higher than somebody that's coming through the door, you know, near bankruptcy with relationships that are falling apart with a spiritual crisis, who are physically unhealthy. You know, ultimately we only have the ability to sustain so much impact mm-hmm. onto us. And so the important part is that we know that the stuff at work is going to happen. We can't go through a career and just say, well, maybe we'll miss this, mm-hmm. right? It's like, becoming a boxer and saying, maybe I'll just never get hit. That's probably not a reality, mm-hmm. regardless of how good you are. And so we need to be doing something ahead of time so that when that impact comes, we have the ability to sustain it. Mm-hmm. And
I love so I have a friend who's in law enforcement and his agency, they work swing shifts where he works days and nights then evenings. Yeah. And so, which is horrible for sleep patterns. And so yeah. he and his buddies are doing some things to develop themselves personally because they know that the stress of the job and this type of work environment is really hard on them. So they're doing things like they're doing cold plunges, they're doing extra workouts, they're doing all these things to take care of themselves personally, even yeah. though the department isn't necessarily pushing them to that direction. So they're right. taking that personal responsibility, which is, I think, is so important. If your department yeah. doesn't provide these things, you're still a human being. You're still responsible for yourself, which I think is yeah. it's a very important point that you're making there.
Right, right. Ultimately, I love the cold plunges. It's a hard sell for most people, but it's.
I've done the cold showers. I don't have a plunge tub, but I've done the showers, which is yeah. kind of shocking anyway. So.
Yes, the evidence in the studies off of that stuff is fantastic. The amount that it raises testosterone, the amount that it raises dopamine, you know, it's all those things. The dopamine bump that you get out of it is, and it actually decreases your cortisol levels. And so you get this huge shift from high cortisol levels, low dopamine, low testosterone to low cortisol levels, high testosterone, high dopamine, which is, that's the feel good that a lot of people are chasing through addictions. Mm-hmm. Is how do I get that little bit of a bump? But yeah, I love what your friends are doing because ultimately, I talk about us being a commodity, right? We are a product and there's a value to our product depending on how well we take care of ourselves. And if we let everything from work spill over into personal life and vice versa, we have to think about the product that we're providing to the people that we care about. If we have friends, kids, spouses, when we come home from work, from that work environment, we're bringing something to them. And so then we have to think about, well, what's my value to the people that count on me? And we want to be always improving that. We want to find ways that we're doing, becoming a better person or working at becoming a better person all the time. And, you know, that's not always going to be a linear climb. You know, we have ups and downs. You know, life does what life does. But I think that that's a good way of trying to frame this of, well, this isn't just about work. And, you know, if I'm doing these things to take care of myself, even if my employer isn't necessarily funding it or completely supporting it, well, am I going to just let myself fall apart because it's not supported there? Or am I going to take care of myself because I'm important enough to take care of?
And if one person does it, it could be a ripple effect across the department, right? If, you know, if your buddy's doing the cold plunge and you're doing these other things, you know, he's going to probably try it too, you know? And so it's going to be a ripple effect, and pretty soon you'll have a healthier work environment because everybody's taking care of themselves.
Right. And behaviors and mindsets become contagious. Mm-hmm. If you have a core group of your department that are doing things, and then people start to see that the result of that is good, it's more likely that people jump onto that bandwagon, if you will, and that starts to become culture, at least of that firehouse. And if you look at firehouses from town to town to town, you can see a lot of different culture. You know, there may be culture in one firehouse, or even shift to shift, you know, that one of them is, you know, quite healthy and positive, and they're working to, you know, towards bettering themselves in different areas. And then you'll see that, you know, that maybe the morale isn't good in another firehouse, and that starts to be contagious as well. And now we start the snowball effect of that keeps going and it keeps going. And now we have a negative culture within that firehouse or within that.
The challenge you have in a lot of firehouses, especially out here on the East Coast, is you have a lot of volunteers and a lot of volunteer, entire firehouses are volunteer. And here in Emmitsburg, our local fire station is mostly volunteer. There's a couple of Frederick County guys that run the ambulance, but just about everybody else is volunteer. So that presents its challenges too.
Right. Yeah. It sure does.
Well, this has been a really fascinating conversation. Can I explain what Resilient Responder is? What is it you guys do, and how can people get in touch with you guys?
Yeah. So the Resilient Responder is a company that I started. It's supported largely by my wife doing all the technical stuff for me. But it's essentially me going out and trying to get this message out about that we have actually the control, the ability to control and change the outcome of things. It is that we don't have to sit back and wait for things to happen to us. We don't have to be victims. We can be proactive. The world doesn't need more victims. What the world needs is more heroes. Mm-hmm. And we need to put ourselves in the position to be useful for ourselves, useful for our families, useful for our communities. And the way we do that is through building resiliency. And so I do as much education as I can in outreach. I work with different fire departments. I provide teaching, consulting, I speak at conferences. And the idea of what we're doing is we're trying to look at 8 different areas of life. And we're trying to take each of those areas and pick them apart and say, if I could make small changes. One of the things that we look for is we're not looking for New Year's resolution type changes, right? We're not looking for that. I'm going to run 5 miles every single day for the rest of the year, because we know that, you know, by and large, that just doesn't happen. What we look at is if we take these areas of our lives and we can make some small changes that we know are attainable and sustainable, and if we multiply those small changes out over the course of time, over the course of a year, how might our life be different at that point? And how much more resilient will we be? If we can get our finances in order, does that free us up for maybe not having to work every single overtime shift that comes by? And so we're missing quality time with our family, and where our sleep is just always disturbed, and we're getting exposed to twice as much trauma from work as we should. Are we looking at our health from our nutritional standpoints? Are we looking at, are we getting some exercise? Are we concerned at all about the quality of our sleep? We're looking at spiritual things. Do I know who I am as a person? This doesn't have to be about religion. It has to be about who am I? If I were to develop a personal mission statement, what does it say about me? Because that allows me to know how I'm going to react to these difficult situations through work that are going to be impressed upon me. It basically is trying to make the whole person a stronger whole person, taking accountability for ourselves and our own actions, and just working continuously to grow as a person in all areas of our life.
That's awesome. And what's the best way for someone to get in touch with you?
So I put this out there because I'm not very famous yet. So my cell phone number is 207-458-0882. And I still tell people, until that thing starts ringing off the hook all hours of the day or night, to just to give me a call or text me. You can find us on Facebook, The Resilient Responder. And you can find us on the web, resilientresponder.com.
Awesome. Well, I'll make sure that I make a connection with you with Jason Fuller down in Texas and get you guys connected so you can be talking and kind of you can learn from each other. So, well, thank you so much for taking time to be on the podcast today. I really appreciate it. Appreciate what you're doing. And I look forward to coming up to Maine and having some lobster.
Connor, yes. Yeah. We get lobster 12 months out of the year up here. Always available. Conrad, I appreciate the invite to be on the podcast, and I appreciate what you're doing for our first responders.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you, Jason, for spending time with me on the show today. And thanks to all of you who have taken time to listen and to watch, and especially if you've taken time to leave a review. And if you haven't done that yet, you still have time. So put a comment in the notes on YouTube or go to Apple Podcasts and leave a review there, leave a rating. That really helps us a lot. And remember, you are not alone. And if you need someone to talk to and don't know where you can turn, you can dial 988 for help. Be sure to tune in next week for another interview with an amazing first responder. And until then, be well, take care of yourself and those around you, and go out and do something great in the world.